is to really get our trucks out on the street as early as possible if the temperatures allow.
D'Esposito says it's all in an effort to keep the roads safe, especially during one of the busiest holiday shopping weekends. Long Island could get anywhere from 3 to 6 inches of snow on Saturday. One of Roy Moore's accusers now admits to forging part of a high school yearbook inscription that she offered as proof that Moore knew her. Beverly Young Nelson says that Moore wrote most of the message and signed the yearbook when she was 16. Roy Moore denies all claims of unwanted advances. The UN says at least 14 peacekeepers are dead after an attack in the Congo. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says at least 40 others are injured after a huge attack on peacekeeping forces. No U.S. casualties were reported. It's the worst attack on UN peacekeepers in the organization's recent history. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Hey, it's Tom Hinchy. For all you Trending Today listeners, we've got a great deal from MyPillow to help you get a better night's sleep. I love MyPillow, and I'm getting a better night's sleep. You can, too. Go to MyPillow.com or call 800-951-8175 and ask for the Radio Listener Special. Use promo code USA, and you'll now get 50% off two MyPillow premium pillows and two Go Anywhere pillows. Call 800-951-8175 or go to MyPillow.com.
As Christmas gets closer, the U.S. Postmaster General has suggestions for holiday mailing. More from USA's Chris Barnes.
U.S. Postal Service CEO Megan Brennan says there are mailing deadlines you've got to observe to guarantee on-time arrival.
For cards and letters by December 19th, and for packages December 20th for priority mail, and December 22nd for priority mail express.
Deadlines for military people serving overseas a little bit tighter, December 11th for letters and December 19th for cards. And Brennan says he can now track your holiday mail with a service called Informed Delivery. I'm Chris Barnes.
FAO Schwartz is making its return to the Big Apple. The famed toy store will move next fall to 30 Rockefeller Plaza. The new space will be about a third of its size of its previous location in the General Motors building on Fifth Avenue. The toy giant had to leave that spot over rent issues in 2015. The biggest planetarium in the Western Hemisphere is opening tomorrow in Jersey City.
It's at Liberty Science Center, and its dome is 20 feet larger than the one at the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. Planetarium Director Mike Shanahan says the all-digital system will feature a seamless screen more than 1,200 square feet wide.
88 million individual pixels are generated by our system to give you the most overwhelming, wonderful view of the heavens.
A view, he says, that'll make you feel like you're flying through the universe. Sarah Lee Kessler, New Jersey.
I'm Ron Taylor, and this is USA Radio News.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon. Today, December 8th. Can you believe it? Seems like it should be July. In any event, I'm Pat Smits. The program is It's the Law. And today I'm going to try to bring you a rather special program, at least I think it is. And before that, let's just talk a bit about the weather, if I can get it up. If I can get it on the screen. There is a notice of hazardous weather conditions. That is the outlook. I think that may be just a tiny bit of snow is what they call hazardous. But let's just see what is the prediction. So tonight there is a chance of snow, about a 40%. By tomorrow it's about an 80% chance of snow. And I guess that's why they consider it hazardous. And frankly, most people, or many people in New Jersey, don't know how to drive in the snow. Just be sure that you understand that SUVs are no better than most cars during the snow. And so at least mostly sunny tomorrow, though, with winds near 38 degrees. And there is, now that's Sunday. And Saturday, there's snow, high of about 34 degrees. They're not really saying how much snow, so it could be just a dusting. And although they do say that it could be 3 to 5 inches, so I didn't see that at first. So there is a possibility of 3 to 5 inches. Just be sure to drive carefully. We all should drive carefully all the time, but with the possibility of snow, it could be a little more treacherous. And as I said, on Sunday, it's mostly sunny. So not tomorrow, then mostly cloudy on Sunday night. And again on Monday, mostly sunny, then a slight chance of showers. So that the high is about 39 degrees on Sunday. And although the high may be about 34 degrees tomorrow, it looks like it's going to get down to freezing, and that's why we'll get the snow. So Monday, as I said, mostly sunny, then a slight chance of snow showers. Same thing on Monday night. And there is a 40% chance of either rain or snow on Tuesday. So we'll be back after just a couple notes from sponsors, and then I'm going to try to give you information about Pearl Harbor and some of the other battles of World War II. And we all have to remember December 7th, and many, many people, of course, don't. And, of course, probably what percentage of our population was not even born in 1941. So that the kids today don't remember it. I'm not sure what they're taught in school. But in any event, I'd like to read something that I think was very poignant. And I'll be back right after these sponsors tell us what they want to say.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Okay, we're back, and as I said, I'm Pat Smiths, and the program is It's the Law, but I've decided today to do something different, and that is I'd like to talk about World War II, and of course, yesterday was the anniversary of the attack at Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. I'm just trying to talk about or look at how many years ago 1941 was. And as if I recall, it was it would have been 76 years ago. And I'd also especially like to dedicate this program to Archie. And if you don't know Archie, then I guess you haven't been in ShopRite. And Archie was in the Battle of the Bulge. Now, granted, that was later in the war. It was one of the last desperate battles of World War II. The winter of 1944 and 1945. But what I'd like to do first is to read something that I think is very poignant. And this was published in the Green Bay, Wisconsin Gazette. And it was written by Robert, or no, it was not written by Robert, yes, it was, excuse me, written by Robert J. Kinderman. But what it was is that in 1997, Robert J. Kinderman drove his father to Maine for one last reunion with his old friend. And as part of that trip, he listened as the old sailors relived December 7th, 1941, and took notes. And the following essay was written in the voice of his father, an old Oshkosh, Wisconsin native. So I'd like to read it because I think it really brings home better than most things what was happening to the individuals in Pearl Harbor at that day. when the Japanese attacked. And by the way, the other thing that one of the reasons why they were not as prepared as perhaps we would have thought is that they were expecting planes coming in. They were supposed to be landing, and so that they took and mistook the Japanese planes for planes coming in from the United States. And if we know our history, we know that there were battleships, I believe there were 8 battleships, all tied up next to one another on that Sunday morning. And the battleships were named after the states. And so that if you've been to Hawaii, you probably know that, or even if you haven't been to Hawaii, you know that the Arizona is still at the bottom of the harbor and oil was still coming out of it, at least it was a couple years ago. But the battleship that this essay is about was the Oklahoma. Okay, so this is I'm reading the article. Running along the rolling capsizing hull of the battleship Oklahoma, I could hear the machine gun rounds of the Japanese fighter plane slamming into the steel hull. I had seen the plane swing into its strafing run, so they were strafing at that point, as Smitty and I sprinted in an effort to avoid the deadly rain of lead as it rapidly closed on us. With no cover, we hit the deck as the rounds tore past us on either side, but by the grace of God, failed to find their mark. As the mighty USS Oklahoma continued on her death roll, we sprinted to the side of her keel and what she might as well have been, or what might as well have been, the edge of hell. All around us, the air was choked with black, acrid smoke, violent explosions of bombs and torpedoes, earth-shattering gunfire, and screams of shipmates dying. 50 feet below us, the water was a sheet of oil and raging fire. We spotted another fighter plane swinging into its strafing run, looking to kill us and other sailors on the exposed side of the Oki. That's what they called their ship. We had gotten lucky in the first pass, but I doubted that luck would hold a second time. "Jump, Smitty," I screamed as the plane opened fire. I saw fear and desperation in his eyes, and I knew Smitty couldn't swim as we launched ourselves into the air, choosing the hell below over the rising, raining down from above. At 7:56 a.m. on December 7, 1941, I, Fireman First Class R.R. Kinderman, was like thousands of other sailors at Pearl Harbor. In our teens or early 20s, we had joined the Navy, eager to serve our country as it approached the brink of war. We also sought to escape the crushing depression of the 1930s as we left home to see the world. On this day, however, we only expected a lazy Sunday morning, never guessing that in the next minute lives would be lost or changed forever. With no warning, a violent, deafening explosion rocked the Oklahoma, knocking me off my feet. I landed hard on the deck, not knowing what had happened. Seconds later, another explosion again knocked me down. "Report to battle stations. This is a real air raid. This is no expletive," came over the intercom. The language alone convinced me that this was not a drill. Hundreds of sailors packed the passageways as we struggled to report to our battle stations. As I raced 3 decks down to the engine compartment, multiple explosions continued to rock the Oki as she stood on a noticeable list to port side. Reaching my station, I and about a dozen others were prepared to fire up the engines in an attempt to get free from battleship row and get underway. Now, as I said, he's referring to battle row, battleship row, and that was because there were 8 battleships lined up right next to one another, and that's why he's saying in this part that they were attempting to prepare to fire up the engines in an attempt to get free from battleship row and get underway. Torpedoes continued to plow into us, and I lost count after 5. The airtight compartments that sealed the ship watertight now sealed the fate of over 400 men who were trapped inside as our ship capsized. In our crowded compartment, all power was gone, lights were out, and no communication with the bridge existed. We were on our own. As more torpedoes slammed and rocked our dying ship, the list increased, and we knew she was going over. Time was short. Decisions were life and death. Several sailors attempted to reopen the hatch through which we had entered, but due to the list, it was too heavy, and water rushed in when they tried. We were trapped. I remember that the air vent in the ceiling overhead was a fresh air duct going 3 decks up to the open deck. It was our only chance, but also possibly a fatal chance. During battle, during battle stations, that open hatch was to be immediately closed and dogged down to maintain the water tight hull. The duct was only big enough for a man to fold his arms and then creep forward. And this was the only possible, as the duct became increasingly horizontal as the ship rolled over. If the hatch was dogged down, anyone in the dark coffin-like air duct would be trapped upside down as the ship rolled over. There would be no escape. 7 of us decided to take our chances, while the rest chose to stay below. On the shoulders of my friend Louis, I tore the vent cover free. Louis hoisted me higher, and I was able to pull myself up into the confining black tunnel as Louis and others followed behind. As the Oki continued to roll over toward capsize, the air duct became more horizontal, allowing us to move more quickly to escape. As we reached the top deck, our prayers were answered when I found the hatch closed but not dogged down. Pushing it open, I dragged myself onto the open deck where the water was within feet of the open hatch. As we rushed to free ourselves, water began flooding into the hatch as the last man was dragged out. Nothing could be done for those who had decided to take their chances down below as the duct flooded in seconds. With the Oki far over on her side, it was now every man for himself. Sliding down the deck into water meant the ship would roll over on you, and even if you were not trapped in debris, there was a great chance of being pulled underwater by the suction of the capsizing hull. Choosing instead to pull myself up the nearly vertical deck, I barely made it over onto the now horizontal side of the ship. Even though less than 15 minutes had passed since the first torpedo had slammed into the Oki, the destruction around me defied belief. Japanese planes filled the air, dropping bombs and torpedoes. Just aft of the Oki, a huge billowing black plume of smoke shot high in the air, followed immediately by a tremendous explosion as the USS Arizona disappeared from my view. Now, this is from me. As we know, the Arizona is still at the bottom of the harbor and never has been lifted from the bottom, although some of the other battleships that were sunk or almost sunk were, in fact, later repaired. But he actually saw the USS Arizona disappear. And he goes on to say, one fighter plane began another strafing run as my ship might Smitty and I sprinted across the barren side of our ship. Having avoided the first strafing, we knew that to remain here was a death sentence. "Jump, Smitty," I screamed, and as we launched ourselves into the air directly into the smoke and flames of burning oil 50 feet below us. Striking my back on the still rising keel threw me off balance, but I plunged into the water without suffering burns. Looking up from the underwater, I was able to see an opening free of burning oil on the surface above, and I swam to it, desperate for air. The intense heat scorched my lungs as I surfaced to draw a breath. Ducking back underwater, I was now able to swim clear of all burning oil. For the briefest moment, I was alone and felt detached from the carnage surrounding me. I even took a moment to cheer as the Oklahoma's sister battleship, the USS Nevada, cleared battleship row and proudly steamed past me with guns blazing as she attempted to clear the harbor and make for safety of open sea. Within seconds, however, she seemed to have caught the attention of every Japanese plane now swarming her, hitting her with everything they had. Despite her gallant efforts to fight back, she soon suffered mortal damage, and her skipper wisely beached her rather than sink and block the harbor entrance. Snapping out of my gaze, I swam to a launch that had broken free as the Oki capsized. Crawling onto it, I found two other sailors already aboard, but unfamiliar with how to start the engine. Having experience with this, I started the engine with one sailor acting as our engineer and another as a coxswain. I took up position and began pulling others from the water. A fourth sailor, who was pulled aboard, dove back overboard as the strafing intensified. As the attack raged around us, we pulled sailor after sailor from the water. A few were in good shape, but most were grievously burned and wounded. Many we never pulled out, as they were already gone. Sailors fitted the bottom of our launch, and to touch them brought new raw agony as charred skin and flesh slipped off of them. So, as we can see, those who escaped into the water, many of them were burned, many of them died, and this, of course, was one man's who did survive, his view. But they were, at this point, they were making their way to Ford Island. So he says, "We were still targets for strafing fighter planes. We covered our heads with life jackets as spent bullets and shrapnel fell to earth. Unloading our wounded, we headed back out, but began taking on water from holes punched through the hull from the strafing. Rather than sink, we chose to ground our launch on Ford Island. For this day, our fight was over, but we were lucky to be alive to fight another day. For thousands of others, like my friend Smitty, their war was over in minutes. They would never get the chance to seek revenge against the Japanese, who had now disappeared over the horizon, leaving in their wake a charred and battered U.S. Pacific fleet. Later that evening, I made my way to an outdoor area where hundreds of survivors were having our wounds treated. For many of us, our ships, our homes were gone. Most important, our shipmates, our brothers were dead. Many, especially from the USS Arizona and Oklahoma, trapped in underwater graves. America was down, but she was far from over or out, as President Roosevelt declared war on Japan with the words, December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in infamy." Incidentally, if you listen to President Trump, he misquoted the quote from Roosevelt. Roosevelt's quote was, in fact, quote, December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in infamy. So then within months, our industrial might was brought to bear as all Americans came together in support and defense and began dealing blows to the Japanese Empire. That night of December 7th, in the only bright moment of the darkest day, I was reunited with my friend and shipmate, Louis, neither of us realizing that the other had survived. We received treatment for our injuries and tried unsuccessfully to catch a few hours of sleep. The next day, we both reported for duty aboard the destroyer USS Hull, number 350, as we headed out to sea in search of the Japanese fleet. I was aboard the Hull in frontline action with Admiral Halsey's fleet throughout the war, from the Battle of Midway and almost every major engagement in the Pacific until the Hull sunk in Typhoon Cobra on December 18, 1944. I survived 3 days and 4 nights in the ocean with 6 others clinging to the only float net with no food or water. By a miracle, we were spotted and rescued by the USS Keller on December 21st, but not before sharks had attacked repeatedly and killed 3 of us. 2 other destroyers, the USS Spence and Monaghan, also were sunk. Between the 3 ships and over 900 shipmates, only 75 of us came home. So isn't that amazing? Only 75 returned after that horrible experience, starting off with Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. He goes on to say, in August 1945, Japan surrendered unconditionally and America could once again move forward. But we would never be the same, and the toll had been great, particularly for the hundreds, or I should say thousands of families that were torn apart, never to become whole again. I was called back to active duty for the Korean War and returned to civilian life with only a broken leg. Like thousands of others, I could finally go home and begin raising a family. I believe in the strength of our country and my fellow Americans. Never again can we allow America to lower its guard. He then goes on to say, Louis and I returned to Pearl Harbor 50 years after that terrible day. Together we walked through the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, where thousands of sailors were buried from that fateful day in 1941. Stopping finally at a mass grave that contained hundreds of our USS Oklahoma shipmates who were unidentifiable, having been trapped underwater when she capsized. Farewells. In 1965, my son, a fifth grader, wrote an essay about my Pearl Harbor experience. He called me a hero. I felt proud, but I had to correct him. That day, I wasn't a hero. The guys who never came home are the heroes. Me, I was just another sailor. So Robert J. Kinderman is a member of the Sons and Daughters of Pearl Harbor Survivors. He said he shared his father's story to fulfill his obligation to keep alive the memory of that fateful day in history, as few survivors remain to do so. And this was his the article that was published, as I said, in the Green Bay Gazette, talking about his father's remembrance. So I'm going to be back to talk more about Pearl Harbor and World War II after we hear from some of our sponsors to keep the powers that be happy.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the chamber.
Hunter Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
Okay, we're back. I'm Pat Smiths. I'm an attorney here and usually talk about what's happening in the law. But today I wanted to do what I consider a special program in light of the fact that yesterday was the 76th anniversary of the massacre at Pearl Harbor. And that's really what it was. It was, some people would say that there should have been an expectation that the Japanese were going to attack, but that sunny Sunday morning, if you've ever seen any photos, certainly no one was on alert for an attack, and they would never have had 8 battleships. I'm going to say parked. I'm sure that they use a different word, but next to each other. And they're lucky that the other ships were out and were not docked at Pearl Harbor. And, of course, as you can see from this essay, they needed to make sure that they didn't block the entrance to Pearl Harbor, and so that at least one ship did not go out, grounded itself, rather than trying to escape and then possibly get sunk and block the harbor. The carriers were all out at sea, and that's why they, you know, did not get demolished in this horrible, horrible attack. And even today, of course, the battleship Arizona is a tourist attraction. And ironically, if you're there, at least when I was there, there were more Japanese tourists than there were American tourists. But in any event, this happened Sunday morning on the 7th of December, 1941. And probably most of us were not born, and certainly there are very few survivors today of World War II. They're dying at an alarming rate. But as we know, we have our own Archie. And as I said, he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and that was one of the last desperate battles of the war in Europe. So that what happened is D-Day, of course, June 6th, 1944, by the winter of 1944 and into 1945, the Allies had liberated France and Belgium. And this was Hitler's last-ditch effort at a counteroffensive. And apparently the German soldiers included, you know, young children, old men, anybody who, you know, could be a body out there. So what had happened is, what was the Battle of the Bulge? Well, what happened is the Germans drove through the Allied lines, and I believe this was in France. They had not yet crossed the Rhine. And anyway, there was a bulge, and that was what they called the Battle of the Bulge, because it was so important to regain and not let the Germans totally get through. And so that was why we called it the Battle of the Bulge. Now, mainly I've been focusing on the war in the Pacific, and I want to continue that because I think there's something else that that was very important in that part of the war, especially against the Japanese, and very few people know about it. And I think I didn't learn about these heroes of World War II until the late 70s. And the reason I found out is I was working on the Navajo Reservation. Now, there is a movie out about the Code Talkers, and Nicolas Cage is in it. Frankly, it doesn't focus where it should focus, and it should have focused on the Navajo Code Talkers. So that, in fact, I believe the first time that they were honored was by President Bush. George Bush did honor some of the surviving Code Talkers. But what am I talking about? Well, they had a real problem because the Japanese were breaking code. It took a long time to translate Morse code. And so that what happened is, and I don't remember the name of the man who did it, but there was an idea that they could use Navajo soldiers and the Navajo language, and they would be able to actually speak the Navajo language with some minor changes, because of course they wouldn't have warships, bombers, airplanes. There were no words in the Navajo language for these things. So by the end of the war, there were over 400 Navajos served as code talkers. 13 were killed in action. The code talkers used their language with training and using some words that would not be for words that are not available in the language. And actually, another interesting fact, I believe, is that over 44,000 Native Americans served in World War II. They were very loyal. I mean, I remember when I worked on the reservation, they were very proud of their service. That wasn't the first war. I believe over something about around 12,000, more than 12,000 Native Americans had served in World War I. Now, the reason, of course, that the Navajo language was so important is that there are very few outsiders. Anyone who has not grown up on the reservation, it's an extremely difficult language to learn. For example, I started taking classes in Navajo, and I think the only thing that I can probably still say, and not very well, with a terrible accent, is yatahe, which is their word for hello. And one of the things about the Navajo language is the inflections, and it's very, very complicated because there are also inflections that are important. I still don't remember. I think it was something like yahete for thank you, and goodbye is ha go ahe ne. But again, that one is really not good for me at all to talk about that. But let's talk about some of the Navajo code talkers, because one of the things that happened is the there are many interesting stories, of course, about the Navajo code talkers and facts that people should know. I think anyone in studying the Second World War, at least when I was growing up in high school, it was certainly taught, not so much in grammar school, but even history classes in college, never heard of the Navajo Code Talkers until I actually was working in legal services on the Navajo Reservation in the late 70s. And I guess one reason that anyone that we had not heard about the Navajo Code Talkers is the fact that they did not disclose this, and I believe, from what I understood at the time, they were not able and were not allowed to talk about their service because they thought that the code could be used again in other wars. But one of the things that the main task of the Navajo Code Talkers was to transmit information and talk on troop movements and the tactics, as well as all crucial battlefield information. And they were able to do that with the use of their dialects over the radios and telegraphs. So the main reason behind and the great value of the code was due to the fact that it had been established using their native language. And it was never broken. The Japanese were never able to break the code. So Native Americans have been serving, as I said, for a long time, over 12,000 in World War I. But the code talkers actually served in six Marine divisions since 1942 up to 1945 during the Second World War. So the divisions included the Marine Parachute Units, the Marine Radio Battalion, battalions actually, and it is a method that had been considered faster compared to the other codes used, including the Morse code, which apparently took several hours to get transmitted. And this is because the messages can be relayed in a few minutes only, just by the Navajos talking in their own language. And there, as I said, there have been more than 400 American Indian Navajo code talkers, but there were less than, apparently, although I find this hard to believe, there were less than 30 non-Navajo persons at the time who could understand such their language. It was an unwritten language. And as I said, the code was classified, and so they could not even acknowledge what the Navajo contribution had been. It was finally declassified in 1968 by the government of the United States. So by the time I worked in the reservation, they were able to disclose that they had been code talkers. They took their place among veterans, the veterans' parades, the Navajo parades. They were very proud of their service. So the Navajo had been the preferred as code language during the Second World War and had been utilized in the Korean War. I didn't realize that, but apparently because it was still classified, it had also been used in the Korean War. As I said, the code talkers' use had ended right after the war in Vietnam. However, this has not been the very first code that was used. And I was surprised about that because I only realized that more recently. Apparently, there were Cherokee troops that belonged to the American 30th Infantry Division serving alongside Britain during the Second Battle of Somme and September 1918. In addition, the Choctaw had contributed in winning over numerous battles during the First World War in France and in other campaigns. And this was because the native language used as code, they were able to, again, use their native language as code. So apparently the Comanche code talkers have been awarded by the French government with the, and I don't know how to pronounce it because it's French, the Chevalier of the National Order of Merit in the year 1989 for the works during the Second World War. So that was the Comanche, and apparently most of us who heard about codes had really thought it was only the Navajo code talkers. So the men that utilized their language against the Germans that were based in northern Africa, and apparently the Basque Indians had not been used heavily except in Australia and also in Hawaii. This was due to the fact that there had been known that there were Basque Jesuits in China, Asia, and Philippines, so that they were concerned that they would be able to break that code. Apparently, Philip Johnston, I forgot his name, but now I remember, Philip Johnston had been the Marine Corps. He actually initiated the Marine Corps program to train and enlist Navajos as messengers. And the reason he came up with the idea, he had been a Navajo, lived with the Navajos, actually lived on the Navajo reservation, and not as a Navajo, but as a son of a missionary. And so he learned the culture and language of the Navajos when he was growing up and living on the reservation. And as I said, very difficult language. I probably could have studied and been there for years and never truly had understood it. And what would happen when I was working on the reservation in the late 70s is many of the older Navajos did not speak much English, so that I would have somebody who would be translating, and they would talk with the translator for, you know, 5 minutes, sometimes more, and the translator would come back in English and, you know, say something in one or two sentences. So it was very frustrating to not understand the language so I could better help the people with their problems. But I didn't know any Anglos who were able to really speak the language, when I was there at least. So, as I said, the Navajo code talkers were extremely difficult to comprehend and understand except by someone who was raised speaking the language. There were no books available in Navajo. And not only, as I said, it not only were the words, but the tonal qualities and the syntax made this unintelligible to anyone with no extensive training and exposure. So there have been, there were also additional, as I said, words and some things that were included in the code in order to get rid of forced code interpretation by native speakers who were captured, so that they really, as I said, it was never understood. So this is, and some of the Navajo code talkers were really, they're interesting because, you know, they came out of the Navajo reservation. And when you're on the reservation, you are really in another country. I was never treated badly. In fact, I was treated, was great. But you really understood that the people had a very different culture, very different language, and it was would have been extremely difficult for anyone to understand, especially the language. I found it very, I enjoyed listening to the language, but I could, very rarely could I even pick out words. And for example, I worked near Gallup, New Mexico, and they had a very flowing, interesting, descriptive way of describing Gallup. But one of the things that in code, code word for America, was our mother. And when you think of how the Native Americans were treated, it was really amazing the service that they provided to this country. If anyone is interested, I suggest going on the internet, and there are quite a few articles. You can even learn to cook fry bread. There are fry bread recipes, and there's some videos. And if you don't know what fry bread is, well, you know what? I have to give another commercial break, and I'll just tell you a little bit more about fry bread when we come back, although that isn't legal either. But by the way, as I said, George Bush honored the some of the surviving code talkers, and I remember one, Albert Smith, although that doesn't sound like a Navajo name, and it isn't really. I mean, most of the Navajos, you know, they're very distinctive names, you know, like Samuel So or Samuel Tom or Joe Vandiver or Chester Nez or Ki Estiti. Now, I can never pronounce that name, but I knew these were all names of people that, you know, were code talkers at the time and went on to, not only did they serve, they had very proud service, and we should be eternally grateful for the work they did. So let me finish up playing some of the spots, and I hope you enjoyed the article. I thought it was very moving and, you know, very important to see what the soldiers endured in, not only, of course, in Pearl Harbor, but throughout that Second World War. And most of us, probably, at least if you were growing up in the 50s and 60s, you had a relative who served, maybe a relative who was killed. I certainly had an uncle who I never knew, of course, and he was killed in the Pacific. I had another uncle who survived the war in the Pacific. And my father also served. He served in naval intelligence and, you know, spent a good part of the war in Brazil, believe it or not. So let me play some spots, and then we'll come back to just finish up.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Honoring Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
¿Sabía que de cada 5 personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Everybody over there! Get on up! to it.
Everybody run down.
Get involved.
Everybody, you.
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Well, I'm back for just a couple minutes, and as I said, I think that the Native American service in World War II was really amazing, and actually everyone's service, because back then kids were drafted out of the small towns. I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and many of the young men joined. Of course, many were drafted, and they really served proudly, came back, and didn't talk about it much. But the other comment I wanted to make is the, as I said, I love fry bread. And I guess I started that because I worked on the reservation. It has no nutritional value, believe me. But the reason it started and reason it is so, I shouldn't say popular among the Native Americans, but one of their staples is that when they were herded onto the reservations, they were given lard and flour. And they were given flour in flour sacks, in cotton flour sacks. And at first, they would dump out the flour and use the sacks for, you know, clothing, etc. So they had to be taught how to, you know, use these. And what do you use? Flour and water. And so they used the lard. They made a kind of a dough of the flour, and it's they pat it out like a tortilla, very thin, and then fry it. And there are a couple different ways of doing it. Some people use yeast, others don't. But in any event, it's basically flour and water and a pinch of baking powder. And for some reason, they all use clabber. I think it's clabber's baking powder. And if you've heard of the Navajo taco is made with fry bread. And at any festival or anywhere out on the reservation, you can certainly get fry bread. And, of course, the meat is usually, I mean, very little beef, but it's usually mutton, which, of course, is the older sheep. That's the meat that they use because sheep are raised throughout the Navajo Reservation. And, of course, they use the wool for Navajo rugs, which are sold and used by them. But mainly their Navajo rugs are sold and to make cash money. And then, of course, the mutton is used to eat. And the Navajo tacos that, as I said, they can be eaten alone or very often their fry bread, of course, can be eaten alone or very often it's Navajo tacos. But in any event, I think that, we all need to think about the service of our, I don't want to say ancestors, but that is for the younger kids, probably is an ancestor, but the service in World War II, and especially, but we thank Archie, who most of us know, and is got to be one of only a few thousand survivors of World War II, and everyone who served. And so that's the end of the program for today.